Welcome back, Red Eyes members. Thank you for joining us. It's excellent to have you with us. We are continuing our interesting discussion with Philip Willan about the different theories about the murder of Roberto Calvi, the trial that took place not too long ago, and Philip's research into these matters. And I'd like to begin to ask you a little bit about, I guess, Masonry in general, and specifically about the P2 Lodge in Italy, its Grand Master Licio Gelli, and what role you think they and him have played in the murder of Roberto Calvi. If I'm not mistaken, I think Calvi himself was a member of P2. Do you know if that's right, Philip?
That's correct. Calvi is believed to have joined the lodge possibly at a ceremony in Geneva. He certainly had a membership card of a kind of parallel organization to P2, which was worldwide organization of Masonic thought and friendship, or some name like that, which was a kind of international arm of P2, also under the control of Licio Gelli. So I think that there's little doubt that Calvi was a member, and in fact he more or less admitted as much, although he was always very evasive on the topic. But it seems that he may have turned to Licio Gelli for help and protection, the kind of political contacts that was the bread and butter of Gelli's activity. He was extremely well connected in Italian politics.
Yes.
Very well plugged into the Italian secret services, almost to the extent that some people believe he was the real head of the military intelligence service at the time. And he was able to provide the kind of networking, political networking that Calvi realized was essential for his business activity, and even more important when his bank was in financial trouble. So it wasn't at all surprising that Calvi should have joined P2. In fact, one of the things that Alberto Jaimez Berti, the Venezuelan man I mentioned, who met Calvi at Chelsea Cloisters in London, or at least claimed that he met him there. One of the things that he told me when we met was that at that time, any really significant business deal that one wanted to carry out in Italy required a green light from P2. He said,
"Yeah, that's right.
P2 was so influential at that time that if you wanted to do something significant in the business field, you couldn't do it without their approval." He may have been exaggerating a bit, but I think not that much. And almost certainly, if P2 did agree to help out with Calvi's various financial difficulties, they would have done so in return for the kind of favors that that he was able to provide as a banker with a bank that spanned the globe and was able to transfer funds very discreetly to Latin America, possibly also to Poland, to Solidarity. And I think that it's very likely that when Calvi found himself in difficulty and was knocking at all the possible doors to ask for money, he would certainly have knocked on Licio Gelli's door. And I think it's very plausible that he could have said to him, "Look, you know, I've helped you with very discreet financial favors in the past. I've supported your global crusade against communism with money from my bank, and you must now help me out, otherwise I will reveal the kind of things that we did together in the course of this global anti-communist crusade, and it's possible that Calvi could have been threatening to reveal very sensitive Western Secret Service operations, for example, if he'd helped to finance them on behalf of P2, and that that kind of thing would have been extremely alarming for Jelly, and Jelly at that time could well have been the kind of person with the clout and the contacts to organize the elimination of Calvi in the way he was eliminated. Mm-hmm. He wasn't actually a defendant at the trial, and relatively recently, some months ago, the prosecutor actually formally shelved the case against him, an investigation into Licio Gelli and a Swiss citizen called Hans Kunz, who was also involved by making available a private plane for some of Calvi's movements, and the movements also of Flavio Carboni and Silvano Vito. And the prosecutor simply said in his request some months ago that although there was sufficient evidence to suspect Gelli of having played a role in the murder, there was not enough evidence to mount a trial against him, so the case has been shelved. Mm-hmm. But there is an interesting military intelligence document that was part of the evidence at the trial, in which an officer of Italian military intelligence describes Calvi going to London with documents to blackmail Gelli in his attempt to save the Banco Ambrosiano. Mm. And Gelli or representatives of Gelli go to London, meet with Calvi, fail to reach an agreement to help him, and then organize for his murder and recover the documents that Calvi was using to threaten them. Mm. And this reconstruction of the events was written very shortly after Calvi's death by an anonymous Secret Service officer. But given that the Secret Services were so much a part of the world that was in play, right, in these events, you know, one feels that they had very good sources of information and were almost protagonists in the story themselves. Mm. So if they offer a reading of these events suggesting that Gelli was involved and was actually involved in the murder, then it's something I think one can take quite seriously, even though he has never been tried and the prosecutor has recently decided that there's insufficient evidence to present a case against him in court.
Hmm. I want to ask a little bit about if you think that Licio Gelli was kind of working with the Vatican as well, then, considering their possible common interest in thwarting communism and other left-wing governments. Do you think that Licio Gelli, considering his position in Italy at that time, might have initiated people from the Vatican in P2 as well, or what do you think happened there?
Yes, that is an allegation that has been made in a number of different forums, and I think it does have a certain plausibility. On the face of it, the Vatican was very hostile to Freemasonry, really for historical reasons, because Freemasonry had played a significant role in the unification of Italy and the creation of the modern Italian state, which had resulted in the loss of power and territory by the Vatican itself, and the Freemasons who participated in the plotting that led to the creation of Italy, and the cutting off of much of the territory that the Vatican had previously occupied in Italy, were naturally seen as enemies. And I think historically, subsequently, that there has been this anti-church bias that has continued in Freemasonry even up until today. So on the face of it, it was a slightly a strange alliance. In fact, at the time, until 1983, Catholics were specifically warned that they would be excommunicated if they joined a Masonic lodge. So it would be very strange to find devout Catholics or even more members of the church or bishops or cardinals signing up to a Masonic lodge. Despite that, there was a natural shared interest in fighting communism. Li Chogeli himself was very passionate anti-communist. He'd been a fascist in his youth. Yes. And had fought in the Spanish Civil War on the side of Franco, together with the other black shirts who were sent by Mussolini, and he had even met Mussolini on his return from Italy and been honored and praised by Mussolini for his role in Spain, where in fact his brother had been one of the black shirt volunteers as well, and had been killed in the fighting there. And I think that had a very profound influence on Gelli's psyche and created this passionate hatred of communism that stayed with him for the rest of his life. So although there was tension and hostility between Freemasonry and the Vatican, there was this shared interest in combining forces to fight against communism. And I think it's possible that as a result of that, Gelli may have succeeded in recruiting influential figures in the Vatican. It's even suggested that Paul Marcinkus himself was a member of a Vatican lodge, and that the kind of organization that would have been best equipped to include members of the Vatican who could never openly admit to being Masons because it was against their own rules, mm-hmm. was precisely P2, because it was the elite lodge and the lodge that was set up to handle members who didn't want their membership of a Masonic lodge to be known by other people, and they didn't want to be troubled by people, other Freemasons asking them for favors or intervention on their behalf in business or in the professional sphere. So it was the very discreet secret lodge that would have been ideal for harboring members of the Vatican. At various times, a list of members of an alleged Vatican lodge has been published. It was published by the journalist Mino Pecorelli, who had very good sources, in the Italian secret services, and who was himself murdered almost certainly because of the information that he handled and possibly was intending to publish. He's someone who you couldn't describe as exactly reliable, but who was certainly very well informed. There's no doubt also that Li Chogeli did have a number of very strong links to important figures in the Vatican. And in his own autobiography, he has described meeting, I think it was Pope Paul VI, and he was the head of a mattress factory, and he, I think, donated a very luxurious bed to the Pope, and he describes this in his autobiography, and clearly it was something that he did to curry favor with the Vatican, and also to kind of penetrate the Vatican environment. And in fact, he has a description of a meeting with the Pope, where the Pope makes a note of a contact telephone number for Jelly, and he asks him cryptically, what is the name that he should use to ask for him? Mm. And given that he presumably knew that he was talking to Licio Jelly, it was almost a suggestion that what was the alias that he should use if he was to ask Jelly to provide very sensitive favors or services to the Vatican. And the whole thing is described in a very kind of conspiratorial manner. One doesn't know how much of it is true or if it is all true, but certainly the impression that Jelly wants to give in his description of this meeting is that he meets the Pope, and the Pope asks him for a very sensitive consultancy services, one could say. Mm-hmm. The implication is that he may have performed very sensitive favors to the Vatican, again, getting him involved in the kind of things that Calvi may also have been involved in this overall context of a global fight against communism.
Hmm. There's some other interesting and curious aspects to this whole story. As if we continue to look at the Vatican, we can, for instance, talk about the death of Pope John Paul I. He died on the 20th of September 1978, and that was actually only after 33 days in office, which gives us a little bit of that kind of Masonic connection again. Do you know if, I don't know if you've researched this at all, but you think that there's another clue there of the possible involvement of Masons, or is it simply someone who's trying to blame the Masons in an obvious way? What's your theory about this?
I did, as I mentioned before, that the first my first contact with these topics was when I did research for David Yalop's book on the alleged murder of John Paul I. And so that was really my introduction to this whole world, conspiratorial world. I have to say that my experience of doing that research was that I began completely skeptical of the thesis that was at the basis of Yalop's book and was at the origin of his research, that he started off mm-hmm. Convinced that John Paul I had been murdered. Certainly that theory had emerged almost immediately after his mysterious and very sudden death. I was very skeptical of it, but over time, doing the research, my belief in it grew steadily. Certainly, I became convinced that something very odd and very grave had happened because of the attitude of some of the people that we interviewed. Mm-hmm. The fact that people appeared to be very anguished and uncomfortable in talking about the subject. And also the fact that the witnesses provided contradictory accounts of what had happened. That one papal secretary would say one thing, and he would be contradicted by the other. So at a certain point, I got the impression that this attitude and the secrecy surrounding his death was concealing some terrible secret, and possibly that he had been murdered, and possibly even that he had been murdered by people within the Vatican.
Yes,
I have to say that since then, I haven't really devoted more time to further research on the subject. But my belief in the theory the murder theory has somewhat slipped, and I've become a kind of agnostic on the subject. I think it's possible that the lies that the Vatican told about the circumstances of John Paul I's death, which were really the cause of the theory that he had been murdered, and gave rise to Gallup's book, which was a huge bestseller and convinced millions of people around the world that the Pope had been murdered, I think it's possible that those lies were simply told to cover up a very minor embarrassment, such as the fact that the person who had discovered the Pope dead was not one of his secretaries, but actually a nun who went into his bedroom and used to take him breakfast in the morning and entered the room and found him dead. And because they thought it was embarrassing and unseemly for a female to have entered the Pope's bedroom, they changed the account of what had happened to say that it was actually one of the secretaries. Mm. So in order to save themselves from a very minor embarrassment about a nun entering the papal bedroom, they ended up convincing millions of people that the Pope had been murdered and they possibly had been involved themselves in the murder. At the moment, I think the jury's out on what exactly happened. Again, I would say that Gallup's book makes an interesting case, but there's insufficient evidence there to convict the suspects that he indicates as possible papal murderers. I think much as the prosecutor in the Calvi murder trial failed to prove his case conclusively, I think Gallup's case is not conclusively proved either. I certainly would not imagine that the 33 days of his papacy has anything to do with the important number for Freemasonry of 33, because I don't think it's possible to organize a murder so very precisely that you can get exactly the symbolic number of days for his papacy that you're looking for. I think, you know, these things, if they happen, they happen in an opportunist way. Mm. And I was recently reminded of this kind of theory when I was speaking to a former member of the Red Brigades who had been involved in the preparation of the kidnapping of Aldo Moro, the head of the Christian Democrat Party, and people considered that the fact that Moro was kidnapped on the morning that he was going into Parliament to help to support a new government that he'd been instrumental in setting up, with the support for the first time ever of the Communist Party, mm-hmm. was proof of the extraordinary power of the Red Brigades, that they could choose this symbolically, politically important day and kidnap him exactly on that day. But the person I was speaking to said that, of course, that's the way it emerged and that's the way it looks to history. But in actual fact, they had no guarantee that they would be able to carry out the operation that day. And their plan was to come back on subsequent days if the circumstances didn't fall into place. So really a chance event enabled them to kidnap the head of the Christian Democrat Party on a day of great political significance. But it was chance rather than their kind of omnipotent power. And equally, I would say the same applies to the death of John Paul I that happened to be after 33 days.
Mm. Even though there might have been prominent figures that were involved in P2 or in other secret organizations that actually was close to to the Pope at that time? I mean, I think...
Yes, that's right. No, there's no doubt that that the Pope became Pope in a political context in which P2 was very influential. The Vatican Bank scandal that and the Banco Ambrosiano bank scandal that would emerge 4 years later was already in the making. And yeah. You know, Calvi was active and Marcinkus was head of the Vatican Bank. So he definitely became Pope within that kind of context and with the suggestions that senior people within the Vatican may have been members of a Masonic lodge, possibly even of P2. Yes, I mean, he definitely became Pope and operated within that context, and certainly those kinds of people could have had a motive for wanting to have him eliminated. I think particularly the financial motive is a plausible one if he was murdered, because there's little doubt that he was very severe on questions of financial morality, and he had had clashes with Marcinkus already about the way in which he ran the Vatican Bank. And it was even drawn to his attention by a leading Italian news magazine shortly after he was elected that there were a lot of financial shenanigans going on in the Vatican at that time that he ought to have a look at, and that probably he would have taken a tough line and insisted on sort of cleaning out the Augean stables of the Vatican Bank. So that yes. financial motive for his murder, I do believe, is quite plausible. And if he was murdered, it wouldn't surprise me if a key reason for his murder was not the trouble at the Vatican Bank, that he would have found entirely unacceptable. It is also interesting that he shortly before he dies, he has a meeting with a representative of the Orthodox Church who comes and has coffee with him in the Vatican. And he actually has a heart attack in the course of his visit to John Paul I in the Vatican. I think after drinking a cup of coffee.
Yes.
I don't know, with the Pope himself or anyway, in the course of his visit. I was aware of this episode, which I think is cited, almost certainly is cited in Yalop's book. But in the course of my own research, I discovered that this particular representative leader of the Orthodox Church had effectively been a representative of the KGB and had been involved in very sensitive negotiations with senior Vatican figures over what was going to happen in Second Vatican Council and whether or not the council would publicly condemn communism. So it was interesting to find that this person who collapses very suspiciously in the Vatican shortly before the very suspicious death of John Paul I had such a sensitive role in the context of Cold War contacts and negotiations between the Vatican and the KGB and yes. the Soviet system. So, I mean, there are many very bizarre twists in this story, and it remains, you know, there's a lot yet to be discovered, I think.
Absolutely. It's definitely interesting, and there's a lot of questions that arise as a consequence of this, obviously. And, you know, you mentioned one thing I want to ask you a little bit more about is you mentioned that Calvi was probably then initiated in Geneva in the P2 Lodge, and there seems to be a lot of Swiss connections back and forth here. As you mentioned, I think Hans Kuntz before as well. He was another Swiss person. Is there anything more you can say about that and the possible connection between, I don't know, mafia or other interests in Switzerland?
Yes, Switzerland is a key element of the story because it was the, along with the IOR, the Vatican Bank, it was the key financial center for Italians who wanted to get their money out of the country, which at the time was illegal because you had a situation where the economy was in severe trouble. There was a lot of alarm about the possibility of a communist party coming to power in Italy. So rich Italians had an incentive to use their money to combat communism and perhaps give it to P2 or Calvi for operations that would make them safe against communism that was a threat to their personal wealth. But they also wanted to get their money out of the country to be sure that it would be available if Italy fell to the communists and also to avoid paying taxes on it. So the conduits that enabled you to get your money out of Italy and to an offshore center where the money would be safe were very important at that time. And the conduits effectively were the Vatican Bank and the Banco Ambrosiano, which also used the Vatican Bank channel. So Switzerland was very important as a financial center for these funds belonging to wealthy anti-communist people and organizations. And Hans Kunz was a very interesting character, a Swiss businessman and financier who became a friend of Flavio Carboni. From the way people tell the story, it appears to be a kind of chance meeting. They bump into one another or meet through common acquaintances in Switzerland and become friends. And Carboni then turns to Kunz for help in organizing Calvi's journey to London when Calvi's on the run and needs assistance, and he needs introductions to people who could access money on his behalf. Mm-hmm. And Kunz possibly had those kind of contacts and the possibility of raising large sums of money in a short period of time. But what is very interesting about Kunz is that he had previously played a very important role in helping Armand Hammer to penetrate the Libyan oil market. And effectively, a part of the success of Armand Hammer as an oil entrepreneur comes from introductions provided by Kunz, who had a Libyan friend who was able to open doors for Hammer in Libya. And in fact, Hammer manages to beat out the competition of the major American oil companies to get very lucrative concessions for exploration and extraction of oil in Libya. And he does this by paying very large bribes to officials of the Libyan government under the monarchy. And he does that with the help of Hans Kunz. So it seems to me to be very interesting that a man like Kunz, who plays this very sensitive role, massive political bribes that open up an important oil market for a man like Armand Hammer. Mm. And Hammer, we have to remember, is a man who bridges the worlds of the United States of America and Russia, that he's a man who has very strong contacts and a strong presence on both sides of the ideological divide.
Yes.
During the Cold War. And this is the man who is helped by Kunz. And Kunz effectively enables Hammer to become what we now know him for, which is the major oil entrepreneur. And he does it by handling very sensitive political bribes. These bribes are paid also through Swiss financial institutions. Mm-hmm. So Kuntz, although we don't know that much about him, is a man at the heart of the great game of the Cold War, of strategic power, of the world's natural resources, of political corruption. Just by chance, he happens to be the man who provides Calvi with the private plane that takes him to London, and he provides the private plane that picks up Flavio Carboni when he needs to escape from England after Calvi's death. So he is a fascinating character, and it seems that although he was possibly questioned in the immediate aftermath of Calvi's death, he was never really seriously investigated at the time.
Right.
I'm sure the prosecutor who mounted the trial in Rome a couple of years ago would have liked to question him, but he wasn't able to get hold of him. He found the Swiss authorities were not very helpful in tracking him down, and he was never able to determine where in the world Kuntz was living and to summons him to give evidence. As I mentioned earlier, together with Jelly, he was a suspect who was under investigation until quite recently.
Yes.
But like Jelly, the prosecutor said the evidence against him was insufficient, was sufficient to suspect him, but not sufficient to bring him to a full trial. So his position was also shelved a few months ago. But again, a very fascinating figure. And one has to wonder whether these people with very significant intelligence or Cold War connections who come into the story and who are never properly questioned or chased up or investigated at the time, whether that's an accident. there's a British lawyer who worked at Slaughter and May, a leading law firm in the city, his business card was found on Calvi's body. Huh. And the police, I think, did go and question him when the card turned up. And they asked him if he knew Calvi and if he'd met him while he was in London. And he said that he had not, he'd had no contact with Calvi, and he had no idea how Calvi came to possess his business card. But it turns out that he also was a very interesting man who had worked for British naval intelligence during the war, and who had business contacts subsequently that appear to indicate that he was still operating in the kind of intelligence arms dealing world. Really? And again, he was never seriously looked at and seriously questioned, never examined, so that his role in the his piece of the mosaic was clear, and the significance of it was clear. It was he was just sort of touched on.
Yeah.
Said he knew nothing about Calvi, hadn't met him, and that was fine. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, that is, as you say, that is very interesting indeed, and one begins, of course, to wonder if there are certain people, pretty much above the law, that are kind of that they can do whatever they want on the world scene, it seems. And just another thing here I want to add to this interesting connection in regards to Switzerland and whatnot, just if you have any input on it or not, I don't know. But, I mean, the Vatican has what they call the Swiss Guard, this pontific guard of Vatican City. I don't know if there's any clue in that in any way, considering the financial power as well of Switzerland, and even the World Economic Forum, I think, hold their meetings in Davos and so forth. Anything to add to that?
Yes, I never thought about the Swiss Guard as a significant connection in this context. Certainly the financial connection, I think, is undoubtedly significant, and the Vatican Bank had part ownership of a Swiss bank at this time, and Switzerland was a very important conduit for the international movement of funds. That was exactly what Calvi had been involved in. It had never occurred to me that the Swiss Guard connection could also sort of form part of that whole general context. Although it is true that some years ago the head of the guard was murdered in Rome, allegedly by one of his underlings, who then committed suicide after killing the head of the guard and his wife. And certainly that case was solved very rapidly indeed by the Vatican, who said that the young man had effectively gone off his head because he was aggrieved that he hadn't been promoted, or that he'd been snubbed by his commander, and he'd had a kind of temporary loss of sanity, during which time he had killed the commander and his wife and then taken his own life. And certainly the rapidity with which Vatican appears to have solved the mystery is a little bit suspicious, there have been suggestions too that commander, whose name I believe was Esterman, possibly had links to Opus Dei, the rather shadowy, very conservative Catholic organization founded by a Spanish priest, and that also that he might have been spying on behalf of the East German Secret Service. So there's a lot of elements in that story that result in it continuing to be something of a puzzle, and the very quick solution offered by the Vatican authorities is perhaps not fully satisfying.
Absolutely not. I mean, all my alarm bells goes off at that point, so to speak. It's just incredible. I wonder if you can mention something about it in we have about 10 minutes or so, 10-15 minutes left here. There's two things I'd like to talk about. You mentioned Opus Dei, and it would be really interesting to go into that as well here at the end. But my mind is drawn back to Operation Gladio here as well, of course, which was prominent within Italy. Do you think there's any connection there as well? Don't know how much research you've done into the matter, or if there's anything you can say about it in connection to what we've been talking about here today.
Yes, one of the people who I interviewed suggested that Operation Gladio was a key part of the activities that Calvi and P2 and Marcinkus had been involved in, and effectively this person who had whose name was Felipe Turova, who had worked for Banco Ambrosiano, connected entity that was involved in collecting funds from clients who failed to pay up in Eastern Europe. This person had operated, good contacts in the Yeltsin government at the time when communist regime was sort of falling to pieces and a new kind of pirate capitalist Russia was emerging. So he had an opportunity to sort of look, to see on both sides of the Iron Curtain, effectively, and he said that his belief was that the basic fundamental activity that had been financed by Marcinkus and Calvi was Operation Gladio, an operation to ensure that the communists didn't come to power in Italy and in other Western countries. And although ostensibly it was an operation that was set up to organize resistance in the event of a communist invasion, the reality was that it was a kind of preventive organization that was scheming politically to ensure that communists didn't come to power through the ballot box, for example, in Italy, where the largest communist party in Western Europe was present. The suggestion is that Gladio or a similar organization was involved in fomenting terrorism and organizing a strategy of tension that would make it difficult or impossible for the communists to achieve power, because it would create a feeling of insecurity and a desire to vote for the major political parties with which people were familiar and which were anti-communist, because very often the terrorist atrocities were at least initially blamed on the communists, or made to appear as though the communists were responsible for them. This person whom I interviewed suggested that the reality of what Calvi, Gelli and Marcinkus had been involved in was a kind of gigantic Operation Gladio to counter communism around the globe. He said that in his view, the instrument for doing this in Eastern Europe and Latin America was the Banco Ambrosiano, and the instrument for projecting a similar kind of sort of parapolitical power in the Arab and Islamic world was BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. Mm-hmm. These were two sort of twin pillars of Secret Service scheming to counter the threats that they perceived as menacing the Western world, initially the communist threat, and then later the emerging Islamic threat. Mm-hmm. It's not something that is proven beyond dispute, but I thought it was an interesting reading of the circumstances and fits in with my own impression that Cold War scheming was at the heart of what happened to Calvi.
Mm. Wow, that's really interesting. And I'm going to have a lot of related links here as well up on the website for people who want to check out some of the more of this, the keywords, so to speak, that we've been talking about today. But let's finish up then and round things up on the note of Opus Dei, and maybe you can give us your tie-in, so to speak, to the whole story and the relationship, or the possible relationship to Opus Dei here, Philip.
Yes, connection to Opus Dei emerges from evidence given by Calvi's widow and his son and daughter, who say that in the last days of his life, when his bank was in trouble, he was hoping to manage to sell it, or at least part of it, possibly the offshore network of companies that he controlled and offshore banks, to Opus Dei, and that Opus Dei was represented possible salvation for him. And also that Opus Dei was represented a kind of strategic choice within the Vatican on how to relate to the Eastern Bloc and to communism, There was a faction in the Vatican that was possibly led by Cardinal Casaroli, who wanted to negotiate with Eastern Bloc leaders and have as the best possible relations with them and compromise and deal and negotiate with them. Whereas there are other much more hardline people who wanted sort of all-out ideological war against them, and Opus Dei fell into this second category. Clearly, Opus Dei didn't step in and save the bank because Calvi died and the bank went bankrupt. And Opus Dei has denied that it was in any way involved in these negotiations. They say effectively they had nothing at all to do with the Calvi business. In fact, they were one of the very few organizations that actually strongly objected to my book and wrote to my publisher complaining about what I'd written about the, in the book. I have to say that they never threatened to sue me, which is something I appreciate. And I did, I believe there was some relatively minor error of fact that I had made concerning them, which I corrected in a subsequent Italian edition. And I hadn't, that they had all along denied this involvement in the Ambrosiano affair, and I hadn't bothered to reprint their denials because you know, it seemed to me that you know, that they were the kind of allegations that an organization almost had to deny in any case. And given that the allegations were made by apparently very good sources, people in Calvi's family who relayed what they claimed Calvi had said to them in person, you know, they were very good sources, very close to the horse's mouth. Of course, it is possible that Calvi could have lied to his own family members, or he even in a sense could have deceived himself, could have led himself to believe that Opus Dei might step in and rescue him when there was no realistic prospect of that happening. But there's little doubt that Opus Dei was a very powerful financial force at the time. They were particularly influential in business life in Spain, and their claims that they were also in some way involved in the activities that were described by Alberto Jaime Sperti, the Venezuelan businessman. So, I mean, I don't have evidence that proves that they were involved or that they were contemplating stepping in and saving Calvi, or even proof that Calvi had direct contact with them. But the fact is that he had confided to his close family members that he was confident that he could save his bank because Opus Dei would step in and help him, and other sources as well. Francesco Pazienza talks about the role of Opus Dei. So I was a bit surprised that they were so sensitive about the allegations in the book, given that there is no doubt that they didn't buy the bank because the bank failed, and if they had bought it, it probably would not have failed. So certainly there's no suggestion that they were involved in Calvi's murder, certainly that I'm aware of, but they simply appear to have been part of the financial and political context in which Calvi was trying to save his bank and save his own life. And of course, he was unsuccessful on both counts.
That is correct. And I mean, there's so many interesting things that we've talked about here today. And again, Philip, I want to thank you so much for coming on the program and sharing some of your insights, research with us here today. Really interesting story about the inner workings almost of the Italian law system, of P2, the Vatican, and much, much more. I want to mention here as well at the end the website, philipvillan.com. That's spelled PHILIPWILLAN, philipvillan.com. We will have this again linked up on redicecreations.com, so you can click through from there easily. And the books are called The Last Supper, The Mafia, The Masons, and The Killing of Roberto Calvi. And also check out the first book, Puppet Masters, The Political Use of Terrorism in Italy. Thank you very much for joining us and coming on the program, Philip.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Henrik.
That's our program for today. Some fascinating connections made and theories discussed. We have a lot of related links up for you on the website as well to check out if you want to look more into these subjects. Thank you for listening and for being a member. We have a lot of good programs ahead of us. Catherine Austin Fitz on the economy and the swine flu issue. Anthony from We Are Change Ireland will join us soon. Rand Flamath on Atlantis. Bob Dean on ET. MEP Martha Andreasen on the corruption within the EU. Tessa Dick, the wife of Philip K. Dick, sci-fi author, and many more in the pipeline. We are also planning webcasts right now with Michael Tesserion, Court Lindahl, and Ben Singleton. Stay tuned to redicecreations.com. Follow along in our busy news section, if you please. My thanks to Frederick and Elizabeth. My name is Henrik. Take good care, and we'll be back before you know it.